does not impact on their, you know, prudence in asking these questions, fundamental questions that they need to ask. So they will be asking you questions and I will be giving them the opportunity. Over to you, Miss. Your 10 minutes starts now.
My name is Mwango Lukaimani, as you have already introduced me, and currently I am employed as the pension funds adjudicator. The brief that I received on issues that I need to address to the committee are the role of the public protector, the functions of the public protector, and why I believe that I'm the best candidate for the appointment. And when I discuss my suitability for the position, I will also touch on the constitutional priorities and values that drive me. As far as the role of the public protector is concerned, South Africa's constitution acknowledges its past history of apartheid that led to the exclusion of the majority of citizens, and therefore it seeks to create a society governed by a supreme constitution that will ensure that such abuses are not repeated. Hence, the public protector's office, which is one of six Chapter 9 institutions that have been established to support and strengthen constitutional democracy. This office is independent and subject only to the constitution and the law. It must be accessible to all, be trustworthy to all citizens, and also it must win the confidence of all in how it conducts its affairs. Currently, Advocate Madonsela has made sure that citizens are not only aware of the existence of the office, but also of its power and authority to correct wrongs. However, in discharging its duties, the public protector must always strike a balance between strengthening and supporting constitutional democracy and the performance of the function. In doing so, you must ensure that actions do not defeat the purpose of the office. Section 182(1) of the Constitution of South Africa confers the following powers upon the public protector: to investigate and any conduct in state affairs or in public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper or to result in any impropriety or prejudice, to report on that conduct and also take appropriate remedial action. The Public Protector Act further empowers the public protector to investigate complaints or suspicions of maladministration, abuse of power, improper or dishonest acts or omissions, or offences referred to in the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. In this instance, then, the public protector is one of several anti-corruption agencies. The public protector further has exclusive powers in terms of the Executive Members Ethics Act to look into breaches of the Ethics Code. Also in terms of the Protected Disclosures Act, as far as whistleblower protection is concerned, the Housing Protection Measures Act, Promotion of Access to Information Act. In doing so, the public protector must look at the action committed, the perpetrator, and then what the situation and society requires in general in recommending any remedial action. The remedial action must, by its nature, be more corrective in nature than retributive. The remedy is meant to counteract or eliminate something that is undesirable and therefore promote good governance in the conduct of state affairs. The original intention, as per our founding fathers, was that it would be that of the role of an ombudsman who has moral power and authority. However, given the Constitutional Court ruling in the Nkandla matter, It has now transformed it into a more litigious platform. And therefore, it becomes even more critical that once a decision is made, it will be important for the public protector to step aside and not be drawn into controversies that might result from such decisions that she might have taken. Why is it that I believe that I'm the best candidate? I am 43 years of age. I have three major dependents. I am in excellent health. I do no less than 7 hours of high-intensity training every week. And I hold very high constitutional and moral values. In terms of my qualifications, I hold a BUris from the University of Venda, an LLB from the University of Pretoria, a Master's in Constitutional Law from UNISA, a Postgraduate Diploma in Management Studies, a Postgraduate Diploma in Financial Planning, a Certificate in Compliance Management, and a Master's of Business Administration from the Vets Business School. Most of these qualifications were qualifications that I did in order to be able to function in the environments that I found myself in, because I do not believe in managing things that I do not necessarily understand. As far as my skills and experience are concerned, I am admitted as an advocate of the High Court in terms of one of the requirements of who can is suitable to be a public protector. Whilst I was at the University of Venda, I practiced part-time whilst lecturing, and I also served as a professional assessor for the High Court that was sitting in Toyando. As far as Section 183C of the Public Protector Act is concerned, I lectured in law at the university, as I've already stated. Whilst lecturing, I also ran a community outreach project called Street Law. Street Law, as you would appreciate, this is when the Constitution was just coming into play, and it was about taking the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to the people. In terms of that, I also had a weekly radio show on various legal issues where people could call in and ask questions related to the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. I also participated in various national research projects that championed human rights, including the drafting of the equality legislation, where I was assisting the Department of Justice with public hearings within the Limpopo province. Whilst at the university, I was also the youngest member of the Senate, which is the highest academic decision-making body at a university. In terms of public administration, from April 2005 to date, I have been involved in public administration. Firstly, as research coordinator at the ISC, general manager human resources at NIA, and chairperson of the ISC. The ISC is the Intelligence Services Council, which is a council. Is the Intelligence Services Council. It's a council that looks into the conditions of service for members of the civilian intelligence service. In terms of that, I was involved in policy development, implementation, review, monitoring, and evaluation. This was also my first brush with the requirements of the Public Finance Management Act. The roles that I was playing, you will note, that involved a lot of stakeholder management and facilitation. I also advised the accounting authority and the executive authorities on all matters related to human resources. In terms of governance, at that stage, we introduced a lot of governance bodies within the intelligence services in terms of human resources in order to deal with appointments, promotions, and performance management in a regulated manner and not leave those to individuals to exercise power over. I also advise
them... Okay, sorry. You have 2 more minutes.
I also advise the Minister on HR matters as head of the ISC and other strategic matters as part of the Ministerial Executive Committee. Currently, as pension funds adjudicator, I started off in 2012 as the deputy pension funds adjudicator. However, I did not have an adjudicator, so I was effectively running the office from the time that I was the deputy. In terms of that, we investigate pension fund-related complaints in an inquisitorial manner. So we actually seek to resolve issues and not find fault. The processes include conciliation, settlements, formal determinations that are akin in stature to High Court decisions. In fact, we file them with the High Court, and if anyone is aggrieved with a decision that I have made, they would then have to appeal that with the High Court that would have jurisdiction over the matter. When I joined the office, there was a backlog. However, currently we are working on 80% of our matters being resolved within 6 months, even though within the past two financial years, the caseload increased by 29% and 39% respectively. And this we managed to do without increasing staff. We just maximized our processes and also our resources. I also have excellent financial management skills, as that would be espoused by the past four annual reports that we have been able to put out, wherein our financial management is quite excellent. I'm able to deliver in a difficult, contested space, as you can imagine. Private pension funds, a lot of money is involved, and I have to look into maladministration and individual complaints from members. As far as my moral value system, I'm honest, I act with integrity, I'm principled, I'm a hard worker, results-oriented, and I'm always able to evaluate facts critically and independently. I'm accountable and responsible, and most of these values that I hold have, over the years, caused me friends, positions, and whatever, but they have not caused me a good night's sleep. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Advocate. I'm going to start this side. I have Honorable Tseke. Is your hand up, Honorable Motapa? Oh, okay. That's very, yeah. Honorable Maisela. So we start with Honorable Tseke, Honorable Maisela, then Honorable Motapo, Honorable Pongo, Honorable Breitenbach, and I'm going to stop there for now. Okay. Thank you. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, ma'am. I think, first of all, I must commend you, and I think the Corruption Watch would also agree with me that since you occupy that office of pensions, a pension fund, you have managed to wipe out all these historically backlogs of complaints received in your office, and we want to commend you on that. And my question, Chair, will relate to the, you know, my question would be, what kind of innovations would you bring to the Office of the Public Protector in making sure that our rural communities, our previously disadvantaged communities, access the services of the Public Protector? I'm raising this because most of the regional offices of the Public Protector offices are closed, and therefore it makes it difficult for our rural communities to access their services. So what innovations can you bring to the Office of the Public Protector? Suppose you are appointed in this post. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Mason.
Thank you, Chair. We would like to ask you to unbundle this situation where our country is not cohesive, and whenever there is any problem with the government and whenever the service delivery lapses, people think that it is corruption and things like that. They never thought of inability or lack of skills or lack of resources or just downright not knowing what to do. but we always say it's corruption and corruption. Is it a question of give a dog a bad name and hang it, or what it is that is actually taking place here? And as a, if you are elected as a public protector, are you always going to say, like everybody else, that is corruption, corruption, and you are going to fight corruption and corruption? Or what it is that you are going to do that will get us out of this, what do you call it, this linguistic song that is sung almost ad nauseam about corruption? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Advocate Lukeme.
Morning, Honorable.
How are you, ma?
I'm well, and you?
Fine. Why are you laughing? Okay, Advocate Lukeme, on page 4 of the questionnaire, section 2 on motivational, I can see that you possess a combination of legal, financial, and management qualification, which are, according to my observation, very much important for the position you are applying for. These are very rare skills. So, how do you intend to apply these skills? Should you be considered for this position of PP? And again, your turnaround time, 7 years backlog, then in 6 months, you collectively with your staff, you managed to reduce that. And as I serve in Portfolio Committee of Justice and Correctional Services, I'm aware that there is a very serious backlog at the Office of Public Protector. So how do you intend transferring these skills or the same modus operandi of the pension fund adjudicator to the Office of Public Protector? And then again, your research skills, very, very, am I taking your question? Why are you laughing? Okay. Your excellent research skills, as alluded to in page 4, also are very, very vital. And then what I would like to know, do you have any investigative skills? Because the post of a public protector, the most important is investigating skills. So I don't know how do they relate to this, your excellent research skills. And thank you for having this top secret clearance. Chairperson, thank you for now.
Okay, yes, Honorable Bongo.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, Advocate.
Morning, Honorable Bongo.
I would like to first start by appreciating the CV has serious accolades.
Thank you.
You know, having started from University of Venda and gaining whatever you've gained today till to date, it's a serious milestone, very serious milestone. But mine is it's about the fit and properness for you. For you to can hold this office of being a public protector. I'm asking this question on the basis that the Act requires that the person must be fit and proper. And as a lawyer, you'll know what are the elements and what constitute fit and proper. So the panelists gave you a questionnaire to fill.
Yes.
At 3.3, they are asking a question whether is there any board that has ever found you guilty, was guilty of unprofessional or disgraceful conduct? And you responded very nicely there by saying no.
Yes.
So I want you to comment about the case that you were not found guilty of assault, which was in 2009. And what is your feeling about the non-disclosure? Because fit and proper has something to do with disclosing all these things to the panel. And also share with the panel about the case where you were found guilty. Apparently you were selling liquor or something. That was in 2009, and I think you were in Toyando. So it says dispossessed of any liquor without necessary license. So I want you to...
Yes.
The first part, the non-disclosure, and your feeling and your comment on the fit and properness to hold this office.
Yes.
And the second part, exactly the explanation of what is contained here.
Yes.
Thank you.
Honorable Breitenberg. Just before I give you the chance to respond to the questions, I see that your main areas of operation, if we were to focus on the fields, it's largely around the state security agency and the pension funds area space.
Yes.
I also wanted to refer you, interestingly, you know, this information that Honorable Bongo is asking you about emanates from the department we are very familiar with,
yes,
which is the State Security Agency.
Yes.
Okay? And they actually say that, and this is very recent, it's 2009.
Yes.
And they are saying you were actually found guilty there and you were selling liquor without the license. Now, looking at this, I know that space of the South African Security Agency, it's a space that I would love to understand better, given, you know, whether we are talking about the quality of the information that is coming there, and I see that you were actually playing a major role in that department. I mean,
yes,
if you were the advisor, you were advising and making recommendations to the Director General in the Intelligence Services. To me, that's a very powerful position.
Mm. Yes.
Now, maybe you might shed some light in terms of what expertise maybe that you got from the State Security Agency that you are going to be bringing to the public protector position. And my second question, because you are in the space of pension funds, we have a lot, and this question relates to how you are going to be balancing the high-profile cases and the ordinary cases of ordinary citizens. And this, as you know, ma'am, we have billions of rands of unclaimed benefits. And most of this money is not the money of your enlightened or your people who are in your upper echelons of life, okay? It's largely your rural people and so forth. And I think, and most of this money, it's those unclaimed benefits, some of them are sitting with the GEPF.
Yes.
Don't you think it's a rights issue as well, human rights issue there? And is there anything that you are going to be bringing into that space so that these people, remember, this is their money, and
yes,
I keep on saying this thing, it's their money, their families worked for this money.
Yes.
It was deducted every month from their salary.
Yes.
It's not like the government is doing them a favor. It's their money.
Yes.
And I just want you to speak into that. Probably, you know, if you address this issue of bringing the balance on the high-profile cases and the ordinary cases, especially from that angle of unclaimed benefits. Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Honourable Chairperson. I think so that I keep the attention of the honourable members. I will start with Honourable Bongo's question so that I deal with the fit and proper issues and then I'll get to all the other matters. The question on 3.3 says, has any legal or other professional body ever found you guilty of any unprofessional or disgraceful conduct? And my truthful answer to that was no. Because in the matter of assault, as you mentioned, it was this matter related to the yet-to-be-completed finalization of my father's estate, where he passed away in 2008, and there was a little bit of wrangling around the issues in terms of his businesses. I happened to just be on the scene, but the person that was making the allegation of assault was actually making that against my sister. However, I was also there. Hence, I was also part of the court process, which matter was then finalized with us. In fact, we were not even supposed to give evidence according to the person that was representing us. However, the magistrates still just wanted to hear what the issue was because there was just no case in the matter. Insofar as the issue of the sale of liquor is concerned, I was not on the premises. I was never on the premises. This was an instance, in fact, of abuse of power, which I reported to the Limpopo provincial office in terms of interference that came in as far up as the MEC's office because of what was in effect a corrupt police official at the local police station who was just doing all sorts of things. I was not on the premises. The premises were sublet to someone else who was operating there. I raised all the issues that were related to that as far high up as with the MEC's office. Nothing happened to that matter. We never got the issue resolved. However, I was never involved, so I don't know how it could be that I have a finding of guilt on something where I was not even on the premises. Excuse me?
Don't worry, you have to respond to this because, you know, and again, it might be the quality of information. I'm not punching holes on the information yes. that we got from your state security agency. And fortunately, you had work in that department.
Yes.
You had work there and, yes. and you can answer them. And we will yes. seek to we will clarify these issues with them, having listened to what you said to us.
Yes, because my re-vetting actually also, Honourable Chairperson, took place after all those incidents, and I was still given my top security clearance. And those issues were never even raised because there were no verdicts in terms of what. I mean, I was found not guilty in terms of the assault issue and the issue of the liquor. There was never even a matter that related to the sale of liquor because I was here in Pretoria and the premises are somewhere in Toyando.
Okay. Honourable Masondo.
Now, just one comment. Mubango.
Yes, Honourable.
It's a beautiful name.
Yes.
Yes. Beautiful name.
Oh.
It's a wonderful name, yeah. So at least there's someone I can relate to now, not just the soapy. But on a more serious note, you see, I mean, there's this thing of liquor and so on, assaults, all of them never happened.
No. I'm not saying they never happened,
Honorable. That's better, yeah.
I have said the issue of the assault, the person was actually alleging that my elder sister assaulted
yes,
them.
I happened
to be with her at the time. Hence, the matter was against the both of us. But even if you go and go through the transcripts and everything, there is no allegation against me as such. I was just there.
So it never happened?
No. In terms of saying
she
it never
is
happened,
saying
I'm not...
The assault, okay, in simple terms, if I'm not paraphrasing
yes.
you, there was some assault that took place,
no,
but
no,
she was... it didn't happen.
The
assault was just an allegation.
That there was an assault.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Oh. So, Honorable Masondo, can you be...
No, I'll leave the issue. It's just that I'm curious.
No.
Because so the assault wasn't
no,
there?
No, it was lies that were being... I am saying this issue is related to the finalization of my father's estate. And this
but I just
is
want
something
to know.
That happened at the premises. This person was alleging that they were assaulted by my elder sister, which was not correct, which was not true, which did not happen. But I just happened to be there also.
These things happened.
No.
So please.
I'm not sure how to.
Honorable Masondo, please. Okay. Proceed, advocate.
Yes. As far as the innovation in terms of the Office of the Public Protector is concerned, I am not certain as to what the current processes are that they use. However, in terms of the way that we were able to, in terms of, I mixed this with another question. Let me deal with the issue of rural communities and access that you posed. I think the way to go on this is to form partnerships with other organizations that might have a footprint within the province. However, in terms of our office, what we have been able to do, because our office is only, when I say our office, I mean the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator, is only situated in Pretoria. Therefore, what we have managed to do is to assess from the number of complaints that we receive, assess where the bulk of the complaints are, and then try and now secure a mobile office in terms of then being able to visit the areas so that people, instead of just receiving complaints, we also share information with people. So issues like that you can look into in terms of instead of putting up a physical office, you just have a mobile office that goes around in order to improve access of the office to rural communities. Also, rural communities, you can make use of headmen and crawls around. That doesn't require any much physical in terms of bricks and mortar. You can be allocated space there to go and then be disseminating information by making use of the infrastructure that might be in place there. In terms of the cohesive country and government issue that relates to service delivery lapses, I think that there is a combination of things that leads to service delivery lapses. One, yes, is a lack of skills and resources. However, usually municipalities have got IDPs that would be in place. And I think one of the things that goes wrong in those local communities is that maybe people are not familiar with what is in the plan to say when will services get to them, and if so, how are they going to be rolled out? However, I am not downplaying the issue of corruption. However, having been in a situation where I have to comply with the Public Finance Management Act, I can tell you that it is possible to achieve everything that you need to achieve in terms of giving, providing service without breaching the Public Finance Management Act or the Municipal Finance Management Act. So the issues where you find that service delivery is not happening because of breaches in the codes or corruption really relates to people just not doing what they have been appointed to do. Again, that can be a combination of things. It could be due to lack of skills and resources, or it can also be something that is due to just plain people trying to take money from the fiscus that does not belong to them in terms of corruption. I was also asked an issue relating to the State Security Agency in terms of my expertise. Within the State Security Agency, as I entered the State Security Agency at the ISC then as a research coordinator, but this is a level that is at chief director level. Therefore, I was involved in the planning and all in terms of senior management planning within the agency. When I went to the National Intelligence Agency then, the National Intelligence Agency had what was called as what was called spending centers. Whilst we were the center, there were things like the academy, the communication center, the ComSec, all those things then we had to support in terms of corporate services. Therefore, you would find that from a policy implementation, review and development, it was us in NIA that were driving these things. For example, we would be implementing systems, those systems would accommodate them. Within NIA, we implemented SAP wall-to-wall in terms of HR and in terms of HR and finance, in terms of integrating those systems as part of HR, not only was I handling the technical aspects of implementing the system itself, but I was also handling the change management aspects to make sure that people move from paper and actually start making use of the integrated system. Also, we had to do a lot of just bringing the service up to speed. When I got there, there were things that could be looked as simplistic, but in terms of providing information to members, it was crucial. For example, within the service, because of the secrecy that would be used, you would find that members did not have their pension numbers reflected on their payslips. They didn't have ordinary things like that. So we had to put all those things in place so that at the end, you can, with your GEPF number, you can check on your benefits, you can do all sorts of things because now your information was integrated and you can get hold of it. But also, we started with the restructuring in terms of building SSA, bringing everything together. I was, from the HR point of view, in terms of the structure, I was involved at ministerial level and also within the agency to try and find a more efficient, effective structure to implement. And at the same time, because you would remember, as I said, there were many spending centers. These spending centers had mutated into their own corporate structures. We had to find a way of bringing everyone into a leaner corporate service structure whilst redeploying the other excess personnel back into core business where they were required. In terms of the question that I received regarding my skills in terms of legal financial management qualifications, it actually, even when I was doing human resources, you would be amazed at how much you rely on, how much I relied on my legal knowledge and skills in terms of just policies and how to give advice. Because unfortunately, within intelligence, you have to have your wits about you in terms of giving advice to say, are we still within what is required in terms of the legal prescript to implement what is required to move the core business forward? So usually you would find that you really had to spend a lot of time analyzing from a legal point of view to say, if we were to implement something like this, would we still be within the law, even if it was a human resources related matter, because of the way that policy drove everything within that environment. My management qualifications, when I completed my MBA, and I also started at the pension funds adjudicator's office, I found that I had to re-engineer processes. I also had to get people to come and focus on a new culture of doing things. At the same time, I had to guard against slowing down production within the environment. So all those things came together in terms of how you plan, how you monitor what it is that we are implementing. In fact, in terms of the backlog, we had a period of time where we had converted a boardroom into a war room. All the files that were the backlog were there, and we could physically see them moving from one stage to another in terms of them being finalized. And at the same time, I realized that in terms of processes, they were far behind in terms of systems. So we implemented a system that could comply with all the audit requirements that would be required from a PFMA point of view, so that you don't implement a system and then find that you are having lapses of governance within that system. I also engaged a lot in terms of what I acquired in my management qualifications with all stakeholders, industry, funds, administrators. In the beginning, people would come into the office to try and size you up, because as you know, in terms of pension funds, there's a lot of money involved. But they soon discovered that as soon as they were sitting in front of me, not only had I done my homework in terms of who they are, what they are there for, what the status of their funds is in, but they got a firm answer from my office in terms of the fact that non-compliance and maladministration will not be tolerated. In terms of the backlog, the way that we managed to handle the backlog was to isolate the matters that were backlog in order to finalize them separately, while the new matters we put onto the new system because we didn't want to cloud all the things. However, we also re-engineered our work processes. Instead of having a linear process of moving a file from here to the next person to the next person, we designed a more integrated process that meant that a line manager got the opportunity to assess the progress of a matter, not as quickly as possible, so that they can give input into that. You talked about my investigative skills. I did indicate that in terms of the pension funds adjudicator's office, our mandate is to resolve complaints. In resolving those complaints, we use inquisitorial skills, which means we don't just take what the complainant is saying and what the respondent is saying. We actually investigate. We ask for more information. We ask for proof. If they say to us they have paid out a benefit, we ask them for proof. So we actually investigate the matters in order to come to a resolution of the complaint. You touched on the issue of pension funds and balancing high-profile cases and ordinary cases, and matters relating to the GEPF and the unclaimed benefits that are currently in the industry. As far as the private pension industry is concerned, the Register of Pension Funds puts that unclaimed benefit figure at about 30 billion rands. However, in GEPF, I am not sure what the number of unclaimed benefits sits at, but I am aware that they also have quite a huge number of complaints. When I joined the Pension Funds Adjudicator's Office, there was mooting that the GEPF would actually, if our act would be amended, their complaints could be dealt with by us. But I think that is a policy decision that would be made when the time is right. However, I have knowledge of the GEPF because when I was at the National Intelligence Agency, the fund that we use from an HR point of view was the Government Employees Pension Fund. And when I first joined at the ISC, we were dealing with the issue of the non-statutory forces pension funds. We were one of the first departments to finalize that whole process because of how we implemented it. We made use of GEPF as a partner, sat with them in terms of confirming people's periods of employment that were supposed to be used. We streamlined that process, and within a short space of time, members that were members of the non-statutory forces could receive a pension benefit statement from the GEPF that would not only indicate what they have amassed since integration, but also what they could attribute to their service within the non-statutory forces. So I have stayed with that knowledge of how GEPF functions. Even now, complainants sometimes complain to our office thinking that we have jurisdiction over. I do not just turn those complainants away. I have streamlined a process with GEPF where I've said to them, I don't want to send people to a call center when they come to me. So we have designed a dedicated mailbox where only matters that are referred from my office are then put through to that dedicated mailbox, and the complainant will receive a letter from our office saying your matter has been referred to GEPF. Please call a particular person, not a call center, but a particular person. I have had to intervene in GEPF. Yes, no. No, no. Yes, yes, yes. And that was partly the problem. I have had to intervene because there were quite a significant number of GEPF members who had, when there was mooting of the change in legislation the previous year, quite a lot of people took their money out. And unscrupulous advisors, instead of putting them in what they thought they were being put into a preservation fund, they were put into retirement annuities where they won't have access to their money until they turn 55. In instances where complaints came to my office, where I would read them and see that it was actually the actions of an unscrupulous advisor that led to that, I would call the life assurance company, tell them that the member should never, even if it was a GEPF member where I didn't have jurisdiction, I would say the member should never have been in this product to start off with. And in some instances, they would agree to reverse that transaction because they would see that I can see from the documentation that the sale of such a policy should never have taken place. The person was sold a wrong product under false pretenses. So, and GEPF forms the highest number of referrals out of my office. Hence, I communicate with them. I also give them trends because I would have reported those matters in as a complaint that we would have received. I would look at them to see what are the trends coming out of the GEPF complaints and report those to the principal officer, who is Mr. Abel Tutole, to say, can you please, in your communication to GEPF members, highlight these rules and these rules and these rules, because these are the trends that are coming out in terms of the complaints that have been lodged, but I have referred to GEPF to deal with. I think I have addressed. I think I've addressed all the.
I think you have. You have. I'm just going to give the last. Nice to see you smiling, Honorable Shivambu. Are you picking me as the chair to give you a chance? Okay. I see Honorable Shivambu has his hand up. Is there any other member who wants to ask a question, Honorable Clannis? Thank you. Okay, so we only have you, Honorable Shivambu.
Maybe Chair.
And after that question, and I'm hoping that he's going to ask a question, not questions, but he is at liberty to do so. But it's a nice way of just encouraging you to find a way of.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe I must take over the questioning session alone, and everyone else can submit the questions because I'm the only one who's awake.
What a cool word. Hey, Floyd.
Advocate the material. Thanks. I see you were born in Mankweng. Did you grow up there?
Yes, until we moved to Venda at the end of 1982.
Oh,
I was 10.
Okay. No, that, in 1982, you're still 10 years old.
Yes, I was.
Oh, okay. No, that's fine. Because I wanted to ask about your political involvement, because I know from the mid-80s, Mankweng had lots of political activities, but I'm sure by that time, when the Mankweng Youth Congress was launched, already you had left that space. But no, I'm interested in your political affiliation. What is your political affiliation in the past and now? And your political views in terms of the current politics. I'm not getting you clearly in terms of your increasing the accessibility of the Public Protector's Office, because it looks like we're still brainstorming that we're thinking about headmen and how we are going to. If we give you the position of Public Protector, you take office on the 1st of September, and then you come to the Justice Portfolio Committee and you must tell us practically and concretely what are you going to do to increase the accessibility of the Public Protector's Office so that the people in Mutare, in Shayandima, in PPD, everywhere else have got access directly. What are you going to say? That is what concretely we want to hear you speak to. And that has got financial implications.
I'm just interrupting you a bit. Probably that headman is actually important.
I want far much more clearer, because the way she posed it was like a brainstorm, not in a way of a concrete plan. So yeah, can speak to that. And in terms of the funding model, there's a bigger challenge of the Public Protector's funding, that there was beginning to be ideas on what could be the funding model of the Public Protector's Office outside of the appropriation process that happened here in Parliament. What do you think should be the funding model of the Public Protector's Office? What other considerations should be made? And do you support the centralized procurement system that is being introduced now by National Treasury as a way of combating tender corruption, where you have a chief procurement officer who's going to primarily be responsible for all state procurement at a central level? I want to hear your view about that. And then second last, quickly, is I'm sure you have read the Secure in Comfort report of the Public Protector, incumbent Public Protector, Advocate Tulima Donsela. Do you think that the president of the ANC was in the wrong when he was cautioned, when the expenditure was 40 million, that there is something happening at your house there and it looks like it's a lot of money, and it escalated to close to 250 million? And he did not do anything to stop it in between there. Do you think that he was in the wrong to do that? I want a much more clearer answer in that question. The last question is, if we were to constitutionally amend the constitution to empower the state to expropriate land without compensation to give to our people, for various purposes, agriculture, residential, religious purposes, would you support such an amendment of the Constitution? You would know that there is a lot of small-scale farmers where you come from, or where you grew up mostly and worked mostly. But majority of the commercial huge lands and farms are owned and controlled by the white minority there. Would you support a program that says that politically let us empower the state to expropriate land without compensation so that we can give access of that land to our people?
Okay, advocate, it would be very interesting if you could, some of the questions that he's asking.
Yes, Chair.
If you could, in answering him, probably help us as well to understand whether this is, whatever ruling that was it done to the president of the ANC or to the actual person that he's referring to, or to the president of the republic. I noticed that Honorable Shivambu tends to draw distinction to that, but that's the nature of this committee. It's a multi-party committee, so different political parties have different perspectives of approaching issues. So please don't take that personal. These are just questions, and they've been going like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I think as far as the issue of accessibility is concerned, yes, my question did come through as a brainstorm, because from where I sit, I do not have first-hand knowledge of what the issues are within the Office of the Public Protector. And I am certain that there are skilled employees that had to deal with the closures of the office that have information that will say, this is what led to the closure of the offices, this is the amount of issues that we are receiving out of this area, and having looked at everything, we are of the view that we could consider 1, 2, 3. I would also be part of such a team, but sitting where I am now, I cannot say this is what is going to happen. The area will dictate how you improve accessibility within it. The kind of issues that might prevail in that area might be issues that do not require people to be there on a day-to-day basis, but on an interval period that is agreeable. So without having seen the extent of the issue, I can only give you what the possible solutions are without saying what the concrete steps would be. That is why the answer came as a form of a brainstorm rather than specifics. In terms of the funding model of the Public Protector's Office, I think in terms of its role, I do not see that it would be appropriate to fund such an office for means other than the appropriation process, because then you might actually be compromising the kind of work that is done there. For example, I would not, if I were to give an example, I would not, as a citizen, I would not be comfortable with an Office of the Public Protector being funded by donor funding, because donor funding would also come with strings and all sorts of other things attached to it to further what that donor company stands for, whether it's whatever particular rights. They could maybe make use of funding outside of the appropriation process to do things like research, but not to deal with complaints, because that will also then put a cloud over when they come out with a decision. It must be that everybody, even the person that the decision is going against, must be able to say the decision was correct, the process that was followed was correct, and there were no other considerations except the matter at hand.
Advocate, I was expecting Honorable Mngwabi to nod, because he's been raised this question, he's been very concerned about the question of donor funding to the Office of the Public Protector. Are you still there, member?
No.
Oh, good. I thought I would just bring this to your attention, Honorable Member, because you've been very concerned about it. and you were very consistent.
As far as the Honorable Chairperson, as far as the centralized procurement system is concerned, we are also, as a very small organization, making use of the centralized procurement system. Yes, it is in its teething stages, but I think over time they will ask for feedback, because it might be that it is actually suitable for larger organizations. I can understand the problem that they are trying to deal with. However, for smaller organizations, for example, for us, some of the issues that we have to comply with in order for us to make use of that centralized procurement system and still be able to come out tops when the Auditor General comes back at the end of the year, require that we get additional staff. So it might be that at a certain point, they have to balance to say who is actually supposed to be making use of this centralized procurement system. Is it suitable for an organization that is running with 55 people and with a budget of 45 million, or is it suitable for people that will be making use of large contracts? So in our instance, it is suitable for certain things, but for most of the things that we are busy with, it really does add an administrative burden to the way that we are to do things. Sometimes you
find... Sorry, Advocate.
Yes.
I just want to say to you, as you answer those questions, if you could be factoring in the last key messages that you want to leave to this panel.
Okay. So that was the issue with the centralized procurement system, to say that there is value in having it, but they should actually look at whether for smaller organizations it's really not cumbersome. I can understand the issue that they are trying to deal with, but maybe it's a question of overkill in terms of smaller organizations. In terms of my political views, I am not sure, because you said current political, and I am not sure what, in terms of commenting about the
Are you a member of any political organization, or were you a member of any political organization?
I was never a card-carrying member of any political organization, and I still am not a card-carrying member of any political organization. That doesn't mean that I'm not politically aware of the... I'm not aware of political developments around me. I have just never belonged to any political party.
That was a nice, straightforward answer.
Yes, thank you, Honorable Chairperson. In terms of the
issue... But can you please stop punctuating the advocate's response?
Honorable Chief Vambo,
she can speak for herself.
Listen, Honorable Chief
Vambo. Yeah, but you can't punctuate. Every time she speaks, you are punctuating.
Sure, advocate has sat here and she is responding to questions that you are asking, and she must know that we are alive and well, we are wide awake, we are listening to everything that she's saying. Advocate, the floor is yours. If you can be moving towards crystallizing your key messages.
Yes. I was also asked a question around the Secure in Comfort report, that in terms of whether the president should have done something when it was brought to his attention that the amount was sitting at 40 million rand. You can correct me, as far as I know, the issue that the amount was sitting at 40 million rand was something that was sitting in a newspaper. Was it brought to his personal attention? Because as far as
it's part of the Secure in Comfort report, actually.
Yes, but as part of the Secure in Comfort report, my understanding was that this initial number was actually mentioned in a newspaper article.
You are responding the way you understand facts.
Yes.
And I think
okay,
it's
let me
fair
let me
for
let
you
me,
to I want to protect you, advocate. Yes. Respond the way you understand the facts and present them from your perspective.
Yes. Chair, thank you. My understanding is that the amount of 40 million rand was highlighted in a newspaper article. And not to take anything away from members of the media, but having been in the state security agencies, there were many days that we would wake up and read things that we knew were not so. So I wouldn't blame someone who would ignore a newspaper article that would be saying that 40 million rand was spent on your home if there was no other evidence that was brought to that person. And really, I am saying this with the utmost respect to the media, to say that there are things that get printed and then you do know that that is not a fact. So it would be up to the person concerned whether they want to go and check on an issue that was sitting in the paper, or if they don't want to go and check on that. I mean, your question is related to when it was 40 million rand. Again, you talked about whether it was the president of the ANC, the president of the country, or the person. My understanding of the report is that there were certain things in the report. The expenditure was in relation to the person, but there were breaches in terms of the code of ethics that were related to the president in his role as the president in terms of he should have complied with certain things that were in the code. But the findings around the expenditure were against him in his personal capacity. As far as the constitution being amended to expropriate land without compensation, and as far as the issue currently might affect small-scale farmers and commercial on commercial land, I think that every time that we think of amending the constitution for any purpose, we must go back to what it is that we want to achieve with our constitution. If we want a constitution that limits power and is inclusive of everyone, then the way that we move ahead with things must not be in a manner that is exclusionary. If you were to bring everyone together and they talk and they agree that, yes, we want to amend the constitution to expropriate land without compensation, then there wouldn't be an issue. However, if there is no agreement, then you risk a situation where we will never achieve social cohesion in this country. However, I am not undermining the issue of land at all, because I think that for the development of people, especially black communities, land is central to how we perceive our ownership and our relationship with our country. Chair, I think I've answered all the questions that I was asked.
Yes, you have answered all the questions. Especially the last one. You answered it. Okay.
Thank you.
Advocate, is there anything that you would like to say before I can release you?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I think in closing, all that I can say is that I have the necessary skills, the necessary experience, and the understanding of the complexities of how government functions and works, and how a complaints environment functions, to be able to take over the baton from Advocate Madonsela without compromising what she has achieved in the eyes of South Africans. Thank you, Chairperson and Honorable Members.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Thank you once more for enduring. It was quite a long time. And I'm hoping that you are going to get a bit of rest now. Okay.
Thank you very much.
For us, we are still going to consider the one more candidate. And good luck, you are released. You shall hear from us once we have processed all the information and it's gone through all the processes of Parliament.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Honorable Chair, Honorable Swart was asking for a break.
Honorable Swart is asking for... this has got nothing to do with you. When you are just, you may be packing up. It's part of our little thingy. I don't know. You know, that is why I said to you, I want to disown this class. I mean, I believe I belong to the finance class. At least, Tina, we would have provided tea. And we would have looked after members consistently. Hey, the justice class, you are failing us.
Because you only sit between 9 and 11 in the morning.
Yeah, and they failed me, man. They did, you know? But we only have Professor Majola now, and we have the last candidate, Professor Majola, who is going to be coming in. Please, members, whilst we are waiting for him to come in, you can just stretch and just get your circulation, you know, thingy going. I know very well, Honorable Kurano. You know, Honorable Kurano.